Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're coming up on the 7th anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene, which caused unexpected and massive destruction in communities across Vermont. If you were here at the time, you'll recall that parts of some towns were cut off from all services. It took days and even weeks to get roads even close to passable again in some places. The National Guard was called out to provide support. Kids had to walk through mountain trails to get to their schools. Farms needed help to find food to keep their livestock alive. Many people lost their homes, a few even lost their lives. There's been a lot of cleanup and hazard mitigation since 2011, but people who concentrate on emergency planning and flooding warn that this type of storm could certainly happen again. So how well prepared are we? Today we're going to look at the state of flood insurance in Vermont, how communities are planning for future emergencies, and what types of hazard mitigation are ongoing in our region. We are joined by Lauren Oates, the state's hazard mitigation officer with Vermont Emergency Management, and Rob Evans, state floodplain manager and coordinator of the National Flood Insurance Program here in Vermont. It's a pleasure to have you both on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks for having me back.
Lauren Oates, is flooding really the most common and most costly natural disaster in Vermont?
It is indeed, globally, in fact, too. We at Vermont Emergency Management have been doing a multi-year stakeholder process, actually, with several subject matter experts in different fields that look at natural hazards, and we've identified fluvial erosion as Vermont's most prevalent hazard and inundation flooding as second.
How much does it cost us?
Good question. Since Tropical Storm Irene, and including Irene in the 2011 spring floods, Vermont has received over nearly $300 million in federal funding from FEMA. So
that's just federal money, $300 million in federal money, plus state money, plus all of the money that individuals and companies have had to spend to repair what damage they had themselves as well.
That's correct.
Rob Evans, if we had all the money in the world and all of the motivation in the world, could we ever prevent flood damage? Or is it sort of fundamentally something that we have to live with and do our best with, but know that it's coming because we're putting man-made structures on the natural environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the old term is flood prevention. Floods happen. Floods are actually a good thing, as long as we don't have our human investments in conflict with those natural flooding and river processes. And so, you know, given our historic settlement patterns, in particular in New England, you know, a river runs through it in just about every community we have. And so realistically, we're not going to be retreating and divesting all of our communities from these areas. So I think our challenge is really to strike the balance on how do we do smart infill and redevelopment in our town and village centers to ensure development is flood safe and we at least, you know, minimize the residual risk. And then how do we identify these flood attenuation assets, as we like to call them in my program, up and downstream of our village centers, where we can really try to protect, conserve, restore floodplains so they do their job, which is to attenuate floodwater, sediment, debris, sometimes ice, depending on the time of the year. So that's really the balancing act we're trying to do here. But, you know, flood resilience is It's a marathon, not a sprint. And we need everybody participating, even if they're walking.
Well, and it sort of sounds like it's not even a marathon. It's just you always have to be jogging forever.
Correct.
You mentioned our settlement patterns, and maybe you could just remind us of that, because we talked about it a lot in 2011. I mean, there were spring floods, and a lot of those were from Lake Champlain and other water bodies that got too full and flooded. But Irene was these rivers that just ripped through communities. And Rob, I mean, this does go back to how we've settled our state and to our state's geology and geography. But can you just really briefly remind us what our settlement patterns are?
Sure, and I think the audience largely knows as well, but I need to remind myself once in a while, which is we settled along our rivers for a reason, for commerce, for economy. The rivers were a source of transportation. We used the mechanical power of rivers to power our mills and to drive logs downstream, and so it was a convenient place to settle and easy to develop because it's flat.
Lauren, if you could be one of those newly fledged peregrine falcons on Vermont cliffs and take us over the state, this sort of bird's eye view of what has changed since 2011, since Irene, what would we see? I mean, what have we done to try to deal with flood hazards and mitigation since then?
To be a peregrine falcon. We've been very successful, actually, working with several nonprofit organizations and our sister agencies, partners, in doing mitigation projects. Most notably, or perhaps not most notably, but notably, is the state buyout program that we've been able to implement that Rob is a strong partner on, as is the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, Vermont Housing Conservation Board. A lot of different organizations are working together to take down those homes and structures that are located in floodways and floodplains so that peregrine falcon would see a lot fewer structures.
We really? Still need to be... How many fewer?
About 150 since Irene, and ongoing, some still pending for Irene. But it's something that the state needs to look at more holistically. We've done quite a few floodplain restoration projects. One in the Otter Creek is always mentioned. The Gund Institute at University of Vermont did a study following Tropical Storm Irene that said, wow, that floodplain restoration project you did down at the Otter Creek saved Middlebury alone over $2 million, or about $2 million in flood damage. So those are the types of projects that the state's trying to really focus on: floodplain restoration, larger holistic approaches to flood resilience in our communities.
And what was done in the Otter Creek in terms of that restoration project that was so successful?
It was actually conservation of land that wasn't really already developed. It was an identification of this land, and Rob might be able to speak to it even better than I can. This land is largely undeveloped. There has been some fill brought in. If we're able to open up that floodplain, do a little bit of excavation work, our river can access its floodplain, instead of going downstream and hitting Middlebury, which is largely developed.
And Rob, I mean, this idea of what to do actually in and right around the rivers is a big one. So floodplains are one, but also some of the work that over the last several decades had been done in Vermont's rivers, and we're thinking riprap and taking things out, actually caused more problems during flooding. So what's being done now to try to repair a more natural state for a river so that flooding is actually not as dangerous as it could be if more has been done?
Yeah, the historic mindset was to get water off the land and downstream as quickly and efficiently as possible. So we have a long legacy of dredging our rivers and piling, you know, that material up to berm and provide what was perceived as flood protection, and straightening our rivers for agriculture. And that process really energized our rivers and streams by containing larger and larger floods within the channel. The fire hose effect, as we like to refer to it, a river should start spilling out onto its floodplain during the 1 to 2 year flood if it's in good condition. But, due to our historic and past actions, we saw 25, 50, in some cases even larger floods contained in the channel. And so that creates an extremely dangerous and erosive situation, because then the river starts to adjust catastrophically to get back to a stable slope and dimension. And so, you know, that's been a really long process that the state of Vermont started really in early 2000, coming off the heels of the 1990 the series of floods in the 1990s, was to first be awakened that, you know, really it's fluvial erosion and river dynamics, and keeping as much water in the channel as possible was the wrong approach. And so obviously we do a lot of education and outreach around river processes and what to do and not do. At the same time, you know, we are promoting restoration. The Mother Nature will do most of the work if we give her the space to do that. But in a lot of cases, what we're doing is trying to jumpstart that process by retreating, pulling structures out, removing those berms, perhaps adjusting the configuration of the river, planting woody buffers that'll help slow down the filter of the water, take the sting out of floods. So we're taking both a passive and active approach, depending on where we are and what we may have funding for.
Alice writes in to say, don't underestimate the importance of soil for mitigating floods. The greater the soil carbon sponge, the easier land absorbs water. Increase the organic matter in lawns, parking lots, and fields to reduce flooding. Steve says, we must begin to look at regions that regularly experience tremendous rainfall, like monsoons or hurricanes, and what they do to slow the runoff from the rain. They have redirected streams, brooks, intermittent washes, and other water features that cross slopes at a slight angle to give the land more time to absorb all of that water. And Bruce in Essex remembers Tropical Storm Irene and Vermonters really working together to help each other, and says, you might call it Vermont strong, yet there is a flip side. I call it Vermont wrong. The haphazard and ad hoc actions of excavators and the like created significant damage to our waterways. That potentially sets us up for even worse flooding in the future and extending the time for waterways and floodplains to recover naturally. And Lauren and Rob, you've both been talking about some of the great work that has been done to try to think more carefully about what happens in a flood and try to restore sort of a natural habitat so that rivers can do what rivers are going to do and with the least damage. But even after Irene, I mean, there were places where that wasn't done or wasn't done well. There have been difficulties with FEMA, with the federal government, in trying to get FEMA to pay for things like larger culverts, flood mitigation rather than just restoration of what was there in the first place. So, Lauren, where are the weak spots?
Weak spots. Yes. So the Steve who wrote in Vermont wrong, that's certainly something that we've had to answer for in the past. And it's hard in a post-disaster world, an immediate post-disaster world, to say, hi, you're flooded, homeowner, resident, you can't access the road, stay out of the river, the state is coming to help, when they have excavation equipment and say, this is what I think should happen. We do have river science that supports not doing that, and channelizing our rivers has caused extreme issues, and it does exacerbate the problems that we have across the state. Things that we could do better is not necessarily just upsizing culverts. We are doing that better. The FEMA has actually recently changed their mind on accepting Vermont's stream alteration general permit as a code and standard. And they've said, Vermont's saying that you must do this, therefore FEMA will fund it, which is it's a wholesale change in the way that they've looked at permitting in the past. And it's just starting to be implemented now, and it's really great.
How many of our culverts have been replaced with bigger culverts? Because that was a big problem, wasn't it?
It was a big problem. I don't have a number on the top of my head, but I have several dozen projects in my queue right now to do that.
Rob, what has it been like working with FEMA on these kinds of not just restoration, but improvement and mitigation measures?
It's been a mixed bag, to be honest. I mean, they are a partner. They're an incredibly important partner because they bring their own federal resources in terms of warm bodies and funding. But, to be honest, they're not a nimble agency, and especially when it comes to funding decisions. What we have to really deal with, the reality is that the cost of free money is time, and that can really be a disincentive when a flood hits and a property owner is interested in the buyout, and then they find out that the timeline to get that money is, could be 3 to 4 years, and sometimes they walk away because they just don't have that time to make themselves whole again. So that's something we're trying to work on and negotiate with FEMA, and what ideas, mechanisms can we put in place perhaps that could make the funding be a little bit more nimble and expedient. We've tossed the idea around of a block grant that the state could get perhaps to administer those funds, but we're hoping to get traction. We're not there yet.
Let's go to Justin, who's calling in from Randolph. Hi, Justin. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just want to comment on the culvert upsizing. So we have a farm that sits in the White River watershed. A large portion of our farm is actually in the floodplain fields. And it's adjacent to a mountain, which has a town road that comes down it. And along that town road is a sizable brook that runs down the road, adjacent to the road, down the mountain, and directly to our farm, and then through our farmland, and then into the White River. After Irene, FEMA required all the towns to upsize their culverts. So that road used to have 2-foot culverts all the way up. The brook comes down, zigzags across the road, and there's culverts where it crosses the road. They're all 2 foot. And a lot of them, couldn't take the water, and the water overflowed the road and washed out the road. Well, now they've all been upsized. So we get any any type of rain event, any significant rain event, we have water instantly down to our farm that is flooding our fields because there's no hold back up along that brook anymore. Those 2-foot culverts used to kind of hold the water back and then let it out slowly. Well, now within minutes of a significant rain event, it is instantly on our farm, and then where the brook crosses our fields, it's overflowing its banks and going across our fields. So upsizing culverts is not always the solution.
Justin, have you talked to, I don't know whether it would be your town managers or who's been running that project, but you know, have you tried to talk to them to figure out a way that your farm can also still operate?
Well, we're still able to operate, but what it's doing, you know, it's flooding our fields, and it's, you know, it's, there's water quality issues because if we've spread manure or if it's in an area where the cows have been grazing, you know, there's a chance for surface runoff into the White River. But, I mean, basically, yeah, I've spoke with them and they said, you know, they're required to, anytime they get FEMA funding, they're required to follow FEMA's guidelines and in regards to culvert sizing. So they can't reduce the size of those culverts. You know, they're required to make them bigger. But what that has done is instead of holding back the water, it's, you know, it's pushing it, you know, it's instantly down to, I mean, within minutes. I'm talking 5 to 10 minutes after a significant rain event.
Justin, that's really interesting, and I appreciate you bringing a real-world example here of, you know, whenever we do something, there's a knock-on effect, and Justin is at the tail end of that knock-on effect of larger culverts. So, Rob, what do you think about what he's saying?
Well, no, he describes something that I think many folks have experienced, and it's really, you know, that what is looked at as a benefit that the undersized culvert, in essence, is providing flood storage, and it likely is, but not by design. And so that there can be downsides with that because it can hold water back for a while, but since it's not really designed from an engineering standpoint to hold back floods of various sizes, including large floods, those structures can break away catastrophically and actually make flooding a lot worse than if you just had a properly sized culvert. And the other thing that just comes to mind, and it's also important, is that, you know, we upsize culverts not just to pass water and sediment and debris, but that's really important for opening up our perennial streams to fish passage as well. And so, you know, I'm not sure if there's a solution to his situation. You know, we have technical assistance we can provide by way of our river management engineers that we have on staff to come and look at the situation. But yeah, that's one of those things that you kind of got this unintended benefit of an undersized structure, but in the grand scheme of things, it may not be best over the long haul.
Lauren Oates, what do you think about Justin's situation?
I agree with everything that Rob said. In addition, it's something that's important, something that you highlighted, is that FEMA comes in after a disaster. They see culvert X, culvert Y. They've been damaged. And FEMA's in the game of risk reduction, which is really we're trying to reduce the amount of damage and federal funding from taxpayers, therefore, to go back and fix this problem. So when we upsize the culvert, the road should theoretically be protected long term, and therefore FEMA comes back, and they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to come back. They don't necessarily, FEMA, consider downstream or upstream implications of doing that type of project. So Jason's issue in Randolph is a perfect example, like you said, of upstream-downstream implications of projects. So it's really on Vermont to be a leader in addressing a more holistic approach to flood mitigation that doesn't necessarily just say, look at this specific location on a map, fix that one problem, and assume that all of the implications down and upstream aren't there.
We're talking today about flood preparedness and mitigation. We're talking about what's been done since 2011, late August of 2011, when Tropical Storm Irene really blew through the state and changed a lot for so many people. And let's also bring in Janelle Hanrahan, Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at Northern Vermont University at Lyndon, where she teaches courses on climate change. She's also the director there of the Climate Consensus Project, where students, professors, and scientists engage the public with the science behind human-caused climate change. Professor Hanrahan, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly do you do in this project? Aren't we all now trying to engage one another on climate change and what might happen?
Unfortunately, not as much as we probably should be. Scientists in particular, atmospheric scientists and climate scientists, until a little more recently, I guess, haven't really done a very good job of communicating with the public. Instead, we're so focused on publishing our research in peer-reviewed journals and presenting at professional conferences. And unfortunately, the general public doesn't usually read our journals or go to our conferences. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to, in addition to teaching our students how to engage professionally, we're also trying to get them to engage with the general public in a variety of ways.
So what are those ways? What are you doing?
So we're going into schools. We've been to several middle schools, high schools. We hold assembly type events. Sometimes we have breakout sessions where we sit down and just talk to the students. One thing we found, and this is actually common among our own students as well, our own undergraduate students here in the Atmospheric Sciences program, is that the students will learn about climate change and learn about the projections and learn about the things that we need to do about it. And then they go home and their parents will say something along the lines of, oh, you don't really believe in climate change, do you? And so it can be kind of a scary experience, I think, sometimes for young people, knowing that this is their future. And so giving them an opportunity to just kind of talk about it is really important. But we've also been engaging in a number of other community events and just trying to be the scientists in the room when needed.
Your university, the NVU Linden Department of Atmospheric Sciences, tweeted out this morning saying, our own Dr. Janelle Hanrahan joins Vermont Edition today for a discussion about what a changing climate means for rainfall and flood risks in New England. And a reply came from another Twitter user named Iger2007 who said, I think it's called weather and it happens. Mm-hmm. So how do you engage people like that who are either rolling their eyes or actively dismissing what you're talking about or not getting it in some way?
Yeah, and I wish I had a quick answer for that. Unfortunately, I'm also not the best at engaging with the public. Most of us aren't because we're just not trained to do it. And what I found is that my students are actually much better than I am at trying to engage with the public, probably because they're more they're a little closer to them in terms of their understanding of the science. I think sometimes we get so wrapped up in the science that we kind of forget how to engage with the public. But generally, my response is it is indeed weather. It's something, you know, we've always seen flooding in our area, but what's happening is that the odds are shifting. So when we have precipitation events, it's essentially raining more now. So the annual average has been steadily increasing, especially in the Northeast. But the more extreme events are also increasing, and those are the ones that are the most alarming.
So what would you like to see in terms of the state and communities when it comes to flood mitigation, hazard mitigation, and communication around flooding? I mean, just the stuff we're talking about here today on the show.
Yeah, so we absolutely have to look at the climate projections. So we look at trends. We look at things that have already been happening. So we know that precipitation is increasing. The extreme precipitation events are increasing the most. But we also need to look at what's happening in the future. And so in order to do that, we can use theory, but oftentimes we use climate models to have a better idea of what's going to happen 50 years out, 100 years out. But one thing we oftentimes forget is that the biggest unknown when it comes to climate change projections, especially going out 100 years, is what human beings will do. So in other words, how much carbon we put into the atmosphere. And so oftentimes we'll use the upper end scenario, worst case scenario, sometimes also called business as usual, and we forget that that's not a given, that doesn't have to happen. So we've already altered our climate, and we're entering a climate system that human beings have never seen at an unprecedented rate. But these conversations need to be had, but hopefully we can lessen the extent of these conversations moving forward for our kids if we actually make some changes now to address it.
Well, it's really interesting stuff, and I look forward to hearing more. And I highly recommend people follow the SciComm hashtag on Twitter if you're interested in this kind of conversation that Professor Hanrahan is having with her students and that they're having with the rest of us. That's as in science communication, so SCICOMM. You can sort of listen in on a lot of discussions with scientists about how they're doing in terms of communication with the general public. Janelle Hanrahan is an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at Northern Vermont University, Linden, where she teaches courses on climate change, and she directs this climate consensus project she's been telling us about. Professor Hanrahan, thanks very much for being on the show today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for the conversation.
We are talking about flooding, flood insurance. We're reflecting on all of this as the 7th anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene in Vermont comes upon us in the next couple of weeks. JC asks, since we know a global sea change, a global sea level rise of up to 2.5 meters is possible this century, it's reasonable to conclude large American coastal populations will be displaced. Is Vermont doing any planning to receive climate refugees who migrate inland? Lauren Oates is the state's hazard mitigation officer with Vermont Emergency Management. Lauren, are you thinking about the potential influx of people from places where there might be more coastal flooding?
That's a fantastic question. And as the only state in New England without a coast, it's something that we do need to be considering. The state hazard mitigation plan update process that we've been going through now, which talks about our vulnerabilities and our hazards, actually addresses climate change refugees as something that we should be considering in the future. It's not something that we're necessarily pouring resources into now, but we know that sea level rise is coming, and Boston is a city that's going to be hit pretty hard with it. So it's something we need to be, as a state, collaboratively thinking about and
so
a region.
It's sort of on the horizon, but not something you're focused on at the moment.
Correct.
Let's talk a little bit about flood insurance, because this is has been a big issue, and it was a really big issue even before Tropical Storm Irene. Some of that spring flooding that we touched upon affected people's and people in their homes, and we discovered some of the problems with flood insurance, especially for homeowners who didn't think that they were in a flood-prone area. There's a national flood insurance program, and this is supposed to cover people for flood insurance who either need to buy it or think they should buy it, because buying flood insurance on the open market would basically be cost prohibitive to almost everybody. So, Rob Evans, I mean, this is something that you work with. You coordinate the National Flood Insurance Program here in Vermont. It's a federal program, but obviously the states have to deal with it. So towns have to participate in order for homeowners to be able to purchase it. How many Vermont towns are participants?
90% of Vermont towns are participating right now. 249 are in the program, and 22 are not enrolled in the program.
And a few have been added to the list since 2011?
We've brought in 16 communities since 2011. I think that there was some motivation there with the pain that was felt with the three federal flood declarations we experienced that summer.
What does it take or cost for a town to be a participant in order for then homeowners to be able to be individual participants in the program?
It's really the cost of municipal staff time to work with our agency to develop a set of floodplain management regulations that they need to administer. That's the quid pro quo of the program. In exchange for flood insurance, the town agrees to regulate their federally mapped floodplains at least to federal minimum standards. And in addition to adopting those regulations and then subsequently enforcing those regulations, there's paperwork that needs to be filled out to apply, and ultimately gets shipped down through FEMA Boston to Washington, D.C. And months later, sometimes many months later, depending on the backlog down there, they are entered into the program, and flood insurance is available for their citizens, as well as hazard mitigation grants that Lauren administers for projects in the floodplain.
So this national program, NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, right now, federally, it's funded through the end of November, but it's going to need congressional reauthorization. And, I mean, this is a program that operates, I think, in the best of times at like almost $1.5 billion loss. And it has a bigger deficit in years where there are really big storms like Sandy or Irene. Is this program in trouble?
It depends on who you ask. I mean, it's a program that, regardless of what side of the aisle you lean toward or are in, everybody hates the National Flood Insurance Program for some reason or another. Unfortunately, I believe it will be reauthorized to the full 5-year extension eventually. I think some of the reasons for its delay this go around have to do with the fact that there was some push by folks to not rush it, given that on one hand you had certain folks lobbying to privatize some or all of the program. On the other hand, you had folks wanting to think about the impacts given with respect to privatizing it, given the lessons learned from the three huge hurricanes that hit us last year in the form of Harvey, Irma, and Maria. So, you know, it's a program that's needed in some form or fashion. I've always been of the opinion that it really ought to be rebuilt from the ground up. It's 50 years old. There's a lot that we know about how effective it's been. And there are a lot of smart people out there with ideas on how to improve it. And so I believe it'll be reauthorized. You know, there was recent forgiveness of the debt by Congress, somewhere in the neighborhood of $16 billion. But it's still over $20 billion in debt.
Yeah, and it's not, that's not going to get better. I mean, if we are anticipating more and worse storms in the future, that's certainly not going to flip directions for how much it costs.
That's correct. And one of the key things that really needs to be addressed is how we deal with these repetitive loss properties. We have some in Vermont, but as you might imagine, in other parts of the country, the Southeast, the Gulf Coast, there are communities that have significant tens of thousands of repetitive loss structures in their flood hazard areas.
Let's go to Marie, who's been waiting on the line with us from Richmond. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to talk more about the future of rivers in Vermont and whether or not the river scientists are going to start asking, like municipalities, when they apply for riprap or something, to look at alternatives or to understand what their impacts will be. If you build a 70-foot-long stretch of riprap along a river, what are the predictable consequences of that? Or if you're going to encourage people to look at those alternatives, because as Ethan's saying, it takes a long time to change people's minds. And I think what you didn't want to say to that farmer was that floodplains are supposed to flood. And that's what happens. Floodplains are supposed to flood. People shouldn't live in floodplains. If you live in a floodplain, you will get flooded repetitively. But I'm mostly interested about the towns. And when a town puts in riprap, are they responsible for what happens downstream?
Marie, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Lauren Oates, how do you work with towns to try to implement what you've been talking about in terms of the best practices as they're known now?
General consensus, even among FEMA staff, has actually been to move away from riprap as policy, a standard, this is what we're going to do in this location, harder projects. The hazard mitigation program that I administer, including a lot of different funding sources, are saying, let's look more holistically, again, I know I keep saying that, at better ways to address this.
But do towns have to? I mean, if a community wants to do a project that doesn't require state funding, or even if it does, do they have to follow those practices?
If the Agency of Natural Resources requires a permit, they do.
And do you then, I mean, are you applying any pressure? Are you hearing of any communities that are not doing these things that you're then saying, look, here's maybe a better approach?
Sure. We certainly have more proactive communities and communities that are a couple of decades behind in how we're addressing how to best serve our rivers.
We got a note from Mark who says the most desirable and appropriate land for development is priced too high to allow all but the most wealthy families or businesses access to build on it. Therefore, land that's less desirable, less appropriate, and cheaper to develop has been used. And, you know, Mark's comment it reflects some of what we saw after Tropical Storm Irene. Some really low-income communities were really hard hit. So how do we make sure that as we address flood mitigation and damage and we think about how to move away from places that are vulnerable, we're not then putting more vulnerable people into those spaces? Lauren, I'll go to you on that first.
Vulnerable populations and addressing them in Vermont has been an ongoing, not problem, but a concern that all of the state agencies and nonprofit organizations are trying to address. So we have been working with different towns to do different elevation projects of homes or mobile home parks that are in floodplains or floodways. A better program would be to get them out of the floodplain or floodway. But as Mark said, those are often more desirable locations and therefore land is more expensive.
Rob, what would you like to see in the next 7 years here as we progress beyond Irene but face the potential of other storms and other events?
I would just like to see the momentum that was established after Irene in terms of really similar to our water quality work, an all-in approach, multiple stakeholders at all levels, really trying to use our rules, tools, leverage dollars to continue to put in place strong land use protections to protect open and undeveloped floodplains and really mitigate our existing risk, for which we still have plenty. So
Yes, certainly we do. And I appreciate both of you being part of this conversation to help keep it in people's minds as we think about both where we've come from and where we're going. Rob Evans is the state floodplain manager, and he coordinates the National Flood Insurance Program in Vermont. Lauren Oates is the state's hazard mitigation officer with Vermont Emergency Management. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.